Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 274. It's Monday, September 16th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's get to it with a story on forever chemicals, this from Scientific American. PFAS in pesticides could pose a greater multi-generational threat than DDT. When the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency ended most uses of the notorious pesticide DDT back in 1972, it wasn't just because of the poison's then suspected links to cancer and serious reproductive effects in humans. Evidence also suggested that the chemical would bioaccumulate in living things and persist in the environment for centuries, threatening the health of our children, our children's children, and beyond, a disturbing reality confirmed by recent research. More than 50 years later, a growing body of research reveals the EPA is failing to fully address a similar and potentially even greater multi-generational chemical threat, the skyrocketing presence of perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, apt doubly PFAS, forever chemicals, in millions of gallons of pesticide products that are widely used across the U.S. PFAS contain chemical bonds that are extremely hard to break, making them difficult to get rid of once they are released into the world. PFAS contamination has been documented in hundreds of species of wildlife from the far reaches of the Arctic to the tropics and the Pacific Ocean. Very low concentrations of many PFAS have been linked to certain cancers, delays in childhood development, and immune system dysfunction in humans. Earlier this year, the EPA set drinking water regulations for six PFAS chemicals, with permissible levels in the excruciatingly minuscule parts per trillion range. When PFAS are present in pesticide products, many of which are sprayed on food crops and run off into nearby waterways, people can be exposed by eating contaminated food and drinking contaminated water. And as I've reported earlier, you can actually get it from the air. It comes down in the rain. Yikes. In a newly published study, we and our colleagues from several environmental watchdog groups identified troubling gaps in the EPA's pesticide approval process that have resulted in the agency failing to fully assess the harms from the growing number of these forever chemicals added to many pesticides. The implications of that glaring lapse could not be more dire. The gaps in pesticide safety oversight, including waiving immunotoxicity studies for pesticides' active ingredients, not fully accounting for the partial transformation of pesticides into different chemicals over time, and failing to assess the cumulative toxicity of PFAS pesticide use. This must be rectified moving forward. Around 1 billion pounds of pesticide products are used each year across hundreds of millions of acres of U.S. farmland, making pesticides some of the nation's most widely distributed pollutants. Simply put, if the goal was to spread forever chemicals as broadly as possible across the nation, there would likely be no more efficient way of doing so than putting them in pesticides. Our study found that 14% of all conventional active ingredients in pesticides are PFAS. Worse yet, the long-lived chemicals comprise 30% of pesticide active ingredients approved in just the past 10 years, meaning that pesticide contamination with PFAS is trending upward and will likely increase in the coming years. Although PFAS are known to leach from plastic storage containers into pesticides, contamination is more often the result of pesticide ingredients that are forever chemicals in their own right. PFAS pesticide ingredients and their degradants, what they turn into after partially breaking down can stick around for decades or centuries and are incredibly potent. But the more potent and persistent the poison, the more likely it is to cause collateral damage. The trend is clear. Pesticide manufacturers are increasingly in the business of making forever pesticides. According to estimates by the U.S. Geological Survey, the nation annually uses 23 million to 35 million pounds of pesticide ingredients that are PFAS. Yet what happens to those increasing loads of forever chemicals once they are sprayed on fields is not well understood. The little we do know is extremely troubling. Although only about 20% of PFAS pesticides have been monitored in U.S. waterways, federal regulators have found nearly all of them in rivers and streams across the nation. The increasing PFASification of pesticides and the resulting environmental contamination are partly the result of regulations that seek to mitigate immediate toxicity concerns without fully accounting for the length of time a chemical would persist in the environment or for the effect of its degradates. Many researchers now believe that beyond a substance's overt toxicities, its persistence alone should be a basis for its regulation, because any release of the substance into the environment will likely be irreversible. And as our understanding of PFAS toxicity grows over time, we have found these chemicals are often more harmful than previously thought. Right now, with summer coming to an end in the U.S., many farmers have already applied pesticides to try to suppress weeds, insects, or fungi. That means tens of millions of pounds of forever chemicals were added to the environment this year alone and will remain there, in one form or another, for the birth of your grandchildren's grandchildren and generations thereafter. It's hard to imagine a more frightening indictment of the chemical-intensive agriculture that has been allowed to evolve in this country, or devolve, as I would say. But farmers are not the problem here. By not accounting for effects that will be realized decades or even centuries from now, EPA regulators are enabling this type of harmful agriculture. The only reason the EPA was able to ban incredibly persistent chemicals such as DDT and PCBs in the 1970s was because the agency acknowledged their long-term harm to society and the environment and faced full-on the difficult task of navigating the political challenges inherent in banning any widely used pesticide product. The agency tasked with the job of protecting our health and the environment must pivot and fully embrace its duty to reverse the fast-emerging threat posed by PFAS. If the EPA fails to face this challenge, it will be responsible for burdening generations to come with increases in deadly chronic diseases and toxic cleanup responsibilities that will, quite literally, last forever. And of course, this article is in the context of the ban of DDT in the U.S. in the 1970s, but DDT is still used elsewhere in the world. And I did an article a while back, reported on an article a while back, that DDT levels in the U.S. population are actually increasing, even though it's been banned 50 years ago for use here. That's because we live in a connected world, both economically, we get food and other products from elsewhere in the world where they use DDT, and we live in an environment where everything gets all mixed up through water and air, dust, you know, blowing around the world. So we can't avoid it by just dealing things within our own border. These chemicals can last for decades, generations, even centuries. And as I've reported on before as well, the amount of profit that's actually made off this PFAS is minuscule compared to the documented massive trillions of dollars of damage that it's doing to human and environmental systems. This one should be a low-hanging fruit to take care of even in our addiction to the worst forms of capitalism. Okay, well, let's move on with our next story. A highly addictive product, nicotine, this from Medical Express. Using AI, researchers find e-cigarette brands are skirting the rules about health warning labels on Instagram. Even though health warnings need to be written on physical products sold in stores and included in traditional advertisements, a new research study led by Boston University found that the majority of ads posted on social media by synthetic nicotine brands left the warnings off. The findings have been published in JAMA Network Open. Synthetic nicotine is a substance created in a laboratory that has the same or very similar chemical structure to the nicotine derived from tobacco leaves. Despite marketing that labels it as tobacco-free nicotine. It still has the same addictive properties and additives that can cause lung damage, cancer, and other health issues. Plus, since it's commonly paired with appealing flavors made from chemicals that are also known to be unsafe to inhale, it can be even harder to quit. The FDA passed a requirement in 2022 that says health warnings need to take up 20% of the advertising and appear in the upper portion of the advertisement for e-cigarettes that contain synthetic nicotine. They also discovered that the posts with health warnings receive fewer likes and comments than posts without the warnings. According to the paper, the larger the warning label, the less comments the posts received. This means that having health warning labels could reduce how many social media users, especially young adults, are seeing and engaging with this content. Our study indicates that e-cigarette brands are creating Instagram posts advertising their products with seemingly no enforcement by the social media platform or government. Instagram lists tobacco products, electronic cigarettes, quote, and any other products that simulate smoking on their list of prohibited branded content. But synthetic nicotine products are flouting that rule. And of course, having a rule that isn't actually enforced is not much better than not having a rule at all.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, let's do a series of stories on suicide and mental health as well. This first one from Medical Express. New series calls for public health model to address suicide. Governments around the world need to address the social and economic factors that contribute to suicide risk, according to a new series calling for a public health approach to suicide prevention. The six-paper series published in The Lancet Public Health argues that despite strong evidence connecting factors such as poverty, homelessness, and unemployment to a heightened risk of suicide, suicide prevention policy tends to focus on individuals' mental health rather than societal factors that can be addressed through a public health approach. University of Melbourne's Professor Jane Perkis co-led the series, and she said, "It is imperative that we have a policy reset which would take a suicide prevention strategy to the next level. While we know that there are sadly many cases of what drives someone to suicide, we are calling for a new approach to look at the broader context of what is going on in someone's life. For example, their financial stability and work, exposure to family violence, and how connected they are in their community. Professor Perkis said, "It's also timely in a cost of living crisis that governments take notice and understand that suicide requires a public health approach." The series argues implementing policies that reduce poverty, provide housing, and eliminate racism and sexism that would yield substantial reductions in the global suicide rate. Policies that regulate industries that either increase the risk of suicide, such as gambling, or provide access to means of suicide, such as firearms, would also lead to a reduction in the rate. Potential policies set out in the series to achieve this include strengthening the social safety net, improving minimum wage legislation, and housing policies. Determining clinical risk factors for suicide, such as existing mental health issues, should continue to play a key part in our prevention strategies, Professor Perkis said. Clinical treatment services are critical for people in suicidal crisis, but upstream measures that address social factors must also be included in national suicide prevention strategies in order to prevent people reaching a crisis point. The public health approach recognizes that individuals do not exist in a vacuum and that their health is influenced by multiple factors in their lives. Suicide is a societal issue that requires a societal response. However, if this ambition is to be realized, it requires significant and meaningful government backing. This means in terms of objectives, commitment, and funding. So this is just another one in my reporting about how mental health is often narrowly viewed as, you know, between your ears, in your brain, when in fact a lot of the pressors, social determinants, are just as important, if not more. And on that note, this from Medical Express, U.S. suicide rates rise in less affluent areas. An analysis of where suicides are occurring in the United States shows that, tragically, location matters. People living in poor areas with fewer resources are significantly more likely to fall victim to suicide versus those living in more affluent areas, new data from the CDC shows. Improving the conditions where people are born, grow, live, work, and age is an often overlooked aspect of suicide prevention, said the report's lead author, CDC health scientist Allison Kamak. Compared to those counties scoring lowest when it comes to income, internet access, and insurance coverage, suicide rates were 26% lower in counties with the highest health insurance coverage, 44% lower in counties where most homes have broadband internet access, and 13% lower in counties with the greatest average household income. Initiatives that reduce these disparities might help bring down suicide rates, Comex said. And next up, we have a story that kind of takes a look at the intersection between mental health and gun violence. This from the Kaiser Family Foundation. What happens 3 months from now? Mental health after Georgia high school shooting. When shootings of any magnitude occur, they often leave the survivors with invisible injuries that can create life-changing symptoms that sometimes paralyze them. But such problems can take time to emerge. Panic attacks and anxiety can spike across a community after a shooting and can be most intense when people return to the scene, said Howard Liu, chair of the Council on Communications for the American Psychiatric Association. So health providers worry that in the coming days, months, and years, the community will struggle to find help for their mental health needs. Barrow County, along a highway that connects Atlanta to the college town of Athens, is a community where agriculture is steadily giving way to development. Prior to the shooting, the area had one standalone inpatient mental health facility located in Gainesville, about 30 miles away from where the shooting occurred in Barrow County, that was constantly overwhelmed, said Sean Couch, a spokesperson for Northeast Georgia Health System. And the latest federal data shows Barrow County would need to add at least 13 full-time providers to no longer be considered a mental health workforce shortage area. We put a Band-Aid on a chronic situation, and that Band-Aid isn't going to last, said Roland Baim, a co-founder of the Georgia Mental Health Policy Partnership, an advocacy group that represents mental health organizations in the state. What happens 3 months from now? The scarcity of mental health providers in Barrow County is emblematic of the state as a whole. Georgia ranks nearly last amongst states in access to mental health care resources, according to Mental Health America, a nonprofit that advocates for increased mental health spending. More than 5 million Georgians live in mental health care professional shortage areas like Barrow County. Paying for mental health care to treat such trauma is difficult nationwide, but Georgia is one of the 10 states that have not fully expanded eligibility for Medicaid, the nation's safety net insurance for those with low incomes, and also the largest payer for mental health services. The state has an uninsured rate of 13.6%, which is 4.1 percentage points higher than the country as a whole, according to 2022 data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Even people with private health plans have trouble finding affordable in-network mental health care because of a lack of providers willing to accept low insurance reimbursement rates, Baim said. Even before the shooting, students at Appalachia High School reported significant mental health challenges. Nearly 200 of the 1,725 student respondents reported that they had seriously considered attempting suicide one or more times in the previous year, according to the latest Georgia Student Health Survey. Top motivators included problems with peers, friends, or family. About half the students from the school who answered said they felt sad, depressed, or withdrawn at least once in the prior 30 days. County residents complained about having to travel for psychiatric care and said the shortage of psychologists and counseling services led to untreated high anxiety and depression rates during a 2019 focus group about healthcare access. The lack of mental health care remained a top concern in the region during a follow-up assessment in 2022. That year, the opioid overdose death rate in Barrow County was among the highest in Georgia, according to state data, and the five-year suicide rate was above the state average. So, of course, effective public health is a long game that plays played over a long time, and you can't just do crisis management where you surge resources in for a short time. That may be helpful in particular crises like large school shootings, but having the baseline and the infrastructure of mental health provision and communities that are healthy is indispensable. Okay, well, related to this, last week I reported on the U.S. Surgeon General's advisory on parental stress, and I wanted to do some more reporting on that to provide some more context for mental health. This from The Hill. Parental stress levels are surging. Here's why. Stress levels among modern-day parents appears to be growing at an alarming rate, so much so that the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy recently issued an advisory calling parental stress an urgent public health issue. Parents in 2024 are handling the traditional challenges of childcare while dealing with stressors, quote, previous generations didn't have to consider, Murthy, who is a father himself, said in the advisory. As a result, 41% of the country's 63 million parents with kids younger than 18 feel so stressed they cannot function, and 48% say their stress is completely overwhelming, according to the advisory. Murthy noted in the advisory that parents now grapple with the complexity of managing social media concerns about the youth mental health crisis and an epidemic of loneliness that disproportionately affects young people. Psychologists and parenting experts who spoke with The Hill said many other societal factors are also contributing to parents' emotional exhaustion, including decreasing access to childcare and changing expectations of what it means to be a good parent. Social media poses huge risks to kids. Experts who spoke with The Hill said the Surgeon General was right in naming social media as one of the biggest parental stressors of the modern era. Many parents struggle to control just how much time their kids spend on apps like Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat, where they could be exposed to dangerous content. In 2022, 97% of teens admitted to using social media, with more than half admitting that it would be hard to give it up, according to data from the Pew Research Center. Most kids are almost constantly checking social media, with a typical teen spending about 5 hours a day using platforms like TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, according to a 2023 Gallup poll. On average, older teen girls are spending the most time on social media, the poll shows. Research shows all that screen time can hinder cognitive, linguistic, and social development in kids and pose risks to their mental health. One 2019 study found that young people who use social media more than 3 hours a day are at a higher risk of developing mental health problems. It's not just the time spent on social media that is detrimental to kids' well-being, but also the content they're exposed to that parents may struggle to monitor, said Mia Smith Bynum, a professor of family science at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Because kids are so engaged online, they're exposed to all kinds of harmful content. Children of color are likely to see abuse by the police when those videos get circulated, she added. We know that that stuff has harmful effects. On top of this, social media gives kids essentially unlimited access to one another outside of school, which makes children vulnerable to being bullied all day, every day. Nearly 60% of teenagers in the U.S. have experienced cyberbullying in their lives, and 63% admit that is a major problem for kids, according to Pew Research. Parents are far more aware of their potential impact. One of the biggest things that has changed for parents over the past century is society's understanding of just how much an impact parents have on well-being and success, according to Christopher Mayes, a research associate professor of family social science at the University of Minnesota. The knowledge that parenting is important has led to positive things, Mayes said, like parents spending more time actively engaged with their children than previous generations. But he said it has also significantly increased pressure on parents to be perfect, which is impossible. No matter what you do as a parent, somebody will tell you that you're doing it wrong. May has said there seems to be a misguided expectation that we should all know what we're doing as parents. This is where the harm social media causes to children overlaps with the harm it poses to parents. Platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok allow never-before-seen access into people's lives, giving others more insight into what parents are dealing with their children than in previous generations, according to Rosanna Bro, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. The content posted to social media is typically positive, making everyone's lives seem much more perfect than they are, according to Tova Klein, an associate professor of psychology at Barnard College and author of the book Raising Resilience, How to Help Our Children Thrive in Times of Uncertainty. This curated perfection can make many parents feel like they're doing a substandard job of raising their children. adding to the already monumental pressures of parenting. Life is messy, and we miss out on that messiness with social media, she said. It makes people feel terrible about everything that they are doing. Child-rearing costs are increasing, while salaries stagnate. The number of Americans who are not sure where their next meal is coming from or where they're going to live is growing, putting major stress on parents struggling to provide food and housing for their families. After years-long decline, food insecurity rates have skyrocketed in the U.S. since 2021, according to the Department of Agriculture. This is partially thanks to inflation, which has caused the cost of food to rise over the past few years. A record number of Americans, over 650,000, experienced homelessness last year, according to a recently released report from Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies. The report explains that homelessness in the U.S. is likely rising because of a recent surge in rental prices, which have been increasing in general faster than salaries recently. This financial strain is especially stressful for parents also dealing with a steep rise in child care costs, which has far outpaced the growth of other family expenses like housing and groceries, according to a report from the First 5 Years Fund. More than half of working parents with infants and toddlers reported having been late to work or needing to leave early from work at least once in the prior 3 months due to child care problems, according to a 2023 report from the Annie Casey Foundation. Almost a quarter of parents with babies or toddlers have been fired from their jobs because of child care issues, the report adds. Part of why parenting matters so much in the U.S. in particular is that we put so much on individual people and individual families to take care of themselves, said Jessica Calarco, a sociology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who specializes in inequality in families. Other countries invest in policies that provide a base level of support and dignity and care for people regardless of their own means. Again, it goes back to social determinants. We need to pay attention to those. We can't just leave everybody on their own, particularly when there's great inequalities that exist. And next up is an interesting story that gets at the stress of strain of parenthood. This from Mass Mutual. Mass Mutual survey, many Americans are opting for child-free lives over the financial strain of parenthood. Nearly a quarter, 23% of millennials and Gen Z without children do not plan to become parents, primarily due to financial reasons. Furthermore, 31% of millennials and Gen Z who say they don't plan to become a parent attribute this to the social and political world their children would inherit. So financial reasons, but also just looking at the social and political world order that we live in and what the children would inherit, not sure they want to bring children into the world. Wow, that's very existential. You're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. My personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if this should turn out to not be the case, I will gladly refund triple your money back. Okay, well, next up, a story on how mental health interfaces with another important issue today, which is access to abortion. This from Medical Express. For many, incomplete answers on mental health care and pregnancy. 18 U.S. states have enacted laws that exclude mental health or risk of suicide among the medical reasons a woman can have an abortion. But women face obstacles finding answers on how to treat mental illness during pregnancy, even when they are not considering abortion. The Food and Drug Administration has not approved psychiatric drugs for use during pregnancy, though they may be prescribed off-label. Instead, pregnant patients are often advised not to discontinue their medications for mental health and substance use disorder because of the risk of exacerbating symptoms or relapsing. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends that patients that do end up stopping medications restart them after birth. Women with a history of postpartum psychosis, for instance, have a 2/3 chance of recurrence without medication. Physicians largely agree that certain medications carry strong risk, especially several used to treat bipolar disorder. Other mental health medications with fewer risks might require more careful monitoring or only be used in case other medications aren't working. And this is just another example of how mental health issues are not treated with parity on equal status as physical health issues.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, have a story on both guns and mental health and a stress for both kids and parents. This from Medical Express. Report, guns remain leading cause of death for U.S. children and teens. A new report from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions underscores a continuing epidemic of gun deaths in the U.S., including among children and especially among black youth. The report, Gun Violence in the United States 2022, examining the burden among children and teens, assessed the latest finalized data from the CDC, highlighting that 48,204 people, the second highest on record, died from gunshots in the U.S. in 2022, including 27,032 suicides, an all-time high for the country. The annual report's major focus this year is on gun deaths among children aged 1 to 17. In the U.S., gun death rates in this age group have increased by 106% since 2013 and have been the leading cause of death among this group since 2020. The report also illuminates the disproportionate impact of gun deaths among black children and teens. In 2022, in the 1 to 17 age group, black children and teens had a gun death rate 18 times higher than that of white children in the same age group. The gun homicide rate among black children and teens rose 5.6% from year over year from 2021 to 2022. The rate of gun suicide among black older teens and emerging adults ages 15 to 19 rose sharply, 24% year over year, surpassing the gun suicide rate among white teens in that age range for the first time. The findings show that after peaking in 2021, their overall U.S. gun violence rate fell 2.7% in 2022, representing 626 fewer deaths. The decline came from a fall in the homicide rate, which decreased almost 8% in 2022, with over 1,300 fewer gun homicides. Gun suicides increased almost 3% over 2021 to just over 27,000, the highest level since the CDC began tracking firearm fatalities in 1968. Other key findings? Firearms accounted for nearly a third of all deaths among 15 to 17-year-olds. From 2013 to 2022, the rates of gun suicide among black youth aged 10 to 17 tripled, and for Hispanic youth aged 10 to 17, more than doubled. Black male teens and young adults aged 15 to 34 accounted for 34% of all gun homicides during 2022, even though they represented just 2% of the total U.S. population. The gun homicide rate for this group was 24 times higher than that for white males in this age group. Over half, that is 55% of deaths among black older teens aged 15 to 17 in 2022 were caused by guns. In 2022, the gun homicide rate among black female teens and young adults aged 15 to 34 was 9 times higher than that of their white female counterparts. Across all age groups, Alaskan natives were 5 times more likely to die by gun homicide than their white counterparts. To help prevent gun violence, the report authors also recommend implementing firearm licensing that includes background checks and requires safety training, policies that remove firearms from those at risk of harming self or others, community violence intervention programs, more stringent permitting for open and concealed carrying of firearms, and repealing stand your ground laws. And last but not least in our regular reporting, this from the Environmental Health Network, Chicago court finds Trump Tower liable for years of river pollution. A Chicago court ruled that Trump Tower violated environmental laws by polluting the Chicago River without permits and killing thousands of fish through its HVAC system. A Cook County judge determined that Trump Tower's HVAC system sucked fish into its cooling system, likely killing thousands since 2008. The building was found guilty of polluting the Chicago River by releasing heated water and misreporting discharge levels. Environmental groups expressed frustration, stating that efforts to restore the river's ecosystem have been undermined by these actions. And the key quote in this article, "Frankly, it's kind of aggravating to be stocking fish into the river while Trump Tower is sucking them out." Why this matters? The ruling highlights ongoing concerns about corporate environmental violations and their long-term impacts on fragile ecosystems. Holding large buildings accountable for damaging practices is key to restoring and protecting urban waterways. And just when you thought you might be aware of all of Trump's legal problems, or should I say illegal problems. Okay, well that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. Okay, 27 bonus stories this week. Let's get to it. First up, National Academies report, wastewater surveillance could be even better for detecting pathogens. So, of course, assessment is a core function of public health, and this National Academies report shows ways that wastewater surveillance could be bolstered by getting more standardization in both their test methods and reporting and expanding the number of pathogens that are put into the list of those that are to be detected. Bonus article 2, studies deepen understanding of LGBTQ plus health disparities. So this is something I've reported on a lot. This article is a pretty good summary of just some of the challenges that LGBTQ folks have to deal with that result in a lot of the health disparities that we see. And once again, that research and understanding a problem is key to a solid evidence-based public health response. Bonus article 3, feds rarely punish hospitals for turning away pregnant patients. Yikes. So this is an important issue for the criminalization of abortion and miscarriage management. And as it turns out, even in these egregious cases, the feds rarely punish hospitals for turning away pregnant patients when they are even legally required to treat them. Bonus article 4, restricting immigrant access to pregnancy-related insurance has public health consequences. So states such as Texas and Florida and others have been restricting immigrant access to pregnancy-related services. And this only scares away those at a very vulnerable time. And there are tens and tens of thousands of babies that are born by undocumented immigrants, and they deserve health as well. Bonus article 5. USDA reports Boar's Head plant posed imminent threat, quote, imminent threat, 2 years before deadly listeria outbreak. So I hadn't reported on this. It only killed 9 people and made sick a whole bunch more, which is pretty serious for a foodborne illness outbreak. But the key thing here is that the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, reported its own report, its own inspections, that 2 years earlier that plant had posed an imminent threat and those violations were not dealt with. Now, the good news is that Boar's Head plant in Virginia has been closed down permanently. It seems that the problems they have could not be adequately remedied. Bonus article 6. Around 560,000 children vaccinated in first round of polio campaign in Gaza. So this is good news. In a terrible war zone, an ongoing genocide, heroic healthcare workers and volunteers were able to get over 500,000 children vaccinated in the first round of this polio campaign. And another 4 weeks after this one, they'll have to do a second dose. So that's good news. Bonus article 7, progress towards polio eradication reversed in Pakistan. So one of the few places in the world where polio, the wild type virus, is still endemic is in Pakistan / Afghanistan. It's actually considered, it crosses a national border, but it's actually considered one pocket of polio. And while progress was being made in recent years, that progress has been reversed in Pakistan. Bonus Article 8. The U.S. is entering a riskier season for spread of H5N1 bird flu. Here's why experts are worried. So this is another good article that overviews where we're at with the bird flu. And I'll just reiterate, one of the key reasons for this title is that as we move into human flu season, if an individual gets infected with both the bird flu and the regular human flu, those viruses in the body at the same time can swap out genetic material, and that could make the bird flu actually transmissible between humans. And that's when we have the risk of a pandemic. Yikes, human-to-human transmission sustained. Bonus Article 9. California faces profound increased risk for valley fever, which is caused by inhaling a soil fungus. Here's how it's connected to weather. So this is another climate change driven disease. So these fungus pollen or whatever that gets thrown up into the air, first of all, it gets produced when you have big swings between wet and dry, wet and dry, wet and dry, which is what climate instability drives. And the particular hot when the soil dries out, then the dust throws up the soil fungus and people breathe it in. So California, that's one thing. It's been kind of a spotty thing over the years, but they're seeing a profound increase in the last couple of years. Bonus Article 10. Militarily defending the U.S. is much more complicated in an era of climate change. So climate change makes a lot of things, most things, a little bit harder in one way or the other. But even defending the U.S. militarily is becoming complicated, partly because it's increasing threats by global instability from a variety of causes, and also it's directly impacting the military. We're seeing bases, particularly naval bases that are on water, are being inundated by flooding and storms and such, causing problems for the Navy, for instance. Bonus Article 11. How a California county got PFAS, forever chemical, out of its drinking water. So I've reported on the technologies that are emerging to be able to do that. Well, Orange County in California has actually had to do this because they have had high PFAS levels. So it can be done. But of course, PFAS is not only present in our drinking water. It's present in food and even air that we breathe. So it'd be better to not put it in the environment at all, so we don't have to try to filter it out, which of course can be expensive, and of course it's going to take years and years to roll that infrastructure out, assuming that happens eventually. Bonus Article 12, hair and skin care products expose kids to hormone disrupting chemicals. So for instance, this is the phthalates that are pretty much universal in a lot of consumer products, like hair and skin care products. These chemicals aren't necessarily forever chemicals. They can actually be, you know, if you get them in your body and you don't get exposed anymore, they'll leave your body in a day or two. You can actually get them out of your body. The problem is there's the phthalates are present in virtually in so many products that almost all of us are exposed to phthalates every single day. So we can never get our levels down. And of course, that increases the average amount that's in our body at any one time, and these are endocrine disrupting chemicals as well. Bonus Article 13, boys with higher levels of PFAS, forever chemicals, enter puberty later. So this is just another example of the endocrine disrupting nature of these chemicals, whether it's PFAS or even these non-forever chemicals, and it causes later puberty in boys. 14, a remote tribe is reeling from widespread illness and cancer due to a cascade of U.S. government failures in transparency and due diligence. So there's often a problem with transparency in government, but particularly when you're dealing with native tribes in the U.S. Just another sad case study of that. Bonus Article 15. Over 3 environmental defenders killed per week on average in 2023 globally. So worldwide, most of the environmental defenders killed are actually indigenous folks. So it's related to that previous story. And they're working hard. The most common thing is fighting mining projects. But there's a lot of environmental defense that's done around the world, and corporations are actually responsible for hiring paramilitaries and assassins to kill environmental defenders. Not good on so many fronts. Bonus Article 16. global study confirms that the prevalence of firearms in U.S. drives the public health crisis in gun deaths. This almost seems like it's so intuitive. It's like, duh. But by looking at countries across the globe, it's a lot easier sometimes when you're doing cross-cultural studies to tease out the different drivers. And in the U.S., it becomes even more clear that the very presence of firearms, a lethal product, of course, is what's driving gun deaths in the U.S. Bonus Article 17. For Afghanistan veterans, problematic anger, not PTSD, is the main problem. So post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, gets a lot of coverage, as it should. It's a very important health issue. But actually, among these Afghan veterans, problematic anger was much more common. And this basically means it's dysfunctional. Anger, of course, isn't necessarily bad, but if you have problematic anger when it's causing problems in your life and the people around you, that's a problem. Bonus Article 18. Is football safe for kids? At least 7 kids have died while playing football already this year in the U.S. as head injuries, heat, and heart conditions take their toll. So if you have kids that are playing football, you might want to read that article. Bonus Article 19. Long-term exercisers have healthier belly fat tissue. So this is an example of another benefit of exercising. So even if you've got a substantial amount of belly fat, that tissue is healthier in people that engage in long-term exercise. It just makes our whole body healthy, even our belly fat healthier. Bonus Article 20. Lifestyle intervention from childhood to adolescence affects metabolism even years later, study finds. So this is just another study that really emphasizes the fact that chronic diseases are chronic, that they develop over many years, and that early lifestyle interventions in life, even childhood, early adulthood, any time in life, can profoundly affect our metabolism and our health even many, many years later. Bonus Article 21. Many U.S. adults with uncontrolled hypertension are unaware of hypertension status. So there's a lot of reasons why for decades we've called high blood pressure the silent epidemic, partly because there are very few symptoms to hypertension. Sometimes sudden death is a symptom, but it doesn't. When people take the medications, often they get symptoms or side effects from the medications and stop taking it for that reason because they figure the medication is worse than the disease or the health condition. But it's something that is a huge risk factor for heart disease and heart deaths. Bonus Article 22, Consumer Reports found high lead levels in a third of cinnamon powders. So there's two, and they list in this article the 12 powders that had the high levels. They didn't detect, of course, everyone in the country. There's a lot of different brands, but unfortunately, a high proportion, a third of these cinnamon powders had high levels of lead. And a lot of this is just due to the fact that the cinnamon plants actually take up lead from their environment. They're coming from all places around the world where there's some, sometimes even worse exposures to environmental lead that are present. And it ends up being in our food supply. So if you're a big cinnamon powder eater, you might want to check that one out as well. Bonus Article 23. A new injectable HIV prevention drug is highly effective, but wildly expensive. So this drug is very effective and it's very convenient because you don't have to take the injection quite as often, but it is super expensive. So this is another example of really where this is driven by the profit of the pharmaceutical companies, more so than actually clinical effectiveness. So this plays into a small set of people where that convenience is a key thing, and it might be worth tens of thousands of dollars a year to have that convenience, but there are other drugs that are very effective, that are very accessible, and much more cost-effective, but that isn't necessarily what the pharmaceutical companies are after. They're for their own profits. Bonus Article 24. Do-it-yourself medicine draws frustrated patients to online forums to learn how to make pirated versions of abortion pills, GLP-1s, which are the weight loss drugs, and other prescription drugs and medical treatments. So this is just a sign that our healthcare system is busted when people can't get access to the actual drugs they need, and they're trying to either make their own pirated versions, or like with these weight loss drugs, they're figuring out ways to try to extend what doses that they have. So may we do a better job.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Bonus Article 25. 25. Tossed medicine, delaying housing, how homeless sweeps are thwarting Medicaid's goals. So this one's another one out of California who has really cracked down and are sweeping through homeless folks on the street or encampments. And of course, often when the police do that, they take a lot or all the belongings of a homeless person, including their prescription drugs, and throw them out. And actually, by moving them around, it's harder for homeless people to engage in a healthcare system, which is one of the things that Medi-Cal, California's Medicaid system, has been trying really hard to improve the health of homeless people. But can you imagine? It's already the most precarious housing situation you can be in, is not having a house, and then moving them around more and throwing out their belongings. Yikes. We can do better and must. 26. The normalization of gambling is fueling addiction. So I've reported on the rise of a gambling, particularly sports betting, that's been expanded in so many states, and this is fueling a lot of addiction. And last but not least, a very interesting article, bonus article 27, conscientiousness, not willpower, is a reliable predictor of success, highlighting importance of durable long-term planning over momentary willpower. So I also kind of like this because it's a metaphor for public health. I always talk about public health as being the long game. It's not just moving from crisis to crisis or one thing as it happens to show up in your life. It's about durable, long-term planning. An interesting thing here, conscientiousness was one of the big five personality traits. People that have the are high on the conscientious trait don't actually have more willpower, but the reason why they're more likely to be successful is because conscientiousness helps with durable long-term planning, and it creates situations, a life that doesn't actually have to engage in willpower as much. So you don't rely on unreliable willpower in the moment. You create an environment in your life, a lifestyle, if you will, that actually does not depend on the less reliable willpower. It's much better to be the house when you're gambling with your health than just the gambler from moment to moment, however exciting that may seem at times. You can listen to these and all the other stories I've reported on in this episode and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.